This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome back to New Books in Gender Studies. I'm the co-host of the channel, Lillian Barger. Today, my conversation is with Kate Kirkpatrick, a lecturer in religion, philosophy, and culture at King's College London, and author of Becoming Beauvoir, A Life, published by Bloomsbury Academic. Kirkpatrick has given us a biography that addresses the puzzle and contradictions of the life of philosopher Simone de Beauvoir, drawn from a never-before-published diaries and letters to tell the fascinating story of how choices shaped her life. Beauvoir, a writer and a feminist icon, won prestigious literary prizes and scandalized many with her now classic, The Second Sex. She's now being celebrated, but during her life, she was a controversial figure, both by conventional and feminist standards. As one who chose to write about lived ideas, both in fiction and essays, rather than build philosophical systems, she was easily dismissed as Jean-Paul Sartre's overly loyal sidekick. Kirkpatrick shows how Beauvoir's thinking evolved as a feminist philosopher, a label she was reluctant to embrace. The author reexamines the overemphasis on Beauvoir's atheism, the extent of her political engagement, and her ethical failures in regard to third parties in the Sartre-Beauvoir relational triads. Beginning with her childhood to her adoption of Sylvie Le Bon, Kirkpatrick focuses on the significant relationships in Beauvoir's life to expand our understanding of how they shaped her thinking about the nature of subjectivity. Becoming Beauvoir demonstrates how the choices we make shape who we become. Here is my conversation with Kate Kirkpatrick.
Let me introduce you to the author, Kate Kirkpatrick. Hello, Kate.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Welcome to the show and thank you for sharing your thoughts. Before we get into the book and a fascinating study, tell us about yourself, your background, and how you came to write Becoming Beauvoir.
Well, my background in philosophy goes back quite a way. I originally studied philosophy and theology at Oxford as an undergraduate, and then I went on to write my doctorate on the early philosophy of Jean-Paul Sartre. And since then, I've published two books on Sartre's philosophy and co-authored a book on the influence of the philosophy of mysticism on existentialism in the French context. And so my interests in Beauvoir actually come from an interest in this period in French philosophy and in the role of philosophy and theology and literature in shaping public discourse.
Okay, let me ask you a question about this Simone de Beauvoir book. A lot has been written about her, and recently she's kind of experiencing a revival.
Yes.
So can you tell me, and I know you've been asked this question, and I think you've addressed it in other public forums, why another book about Simone de Beauvoir, especially another biography?
Well, because I think that although there's a lot of excellent scholarship about Beauvoir by philosophers and people working in feminist theory and French literature, the public reputation of Beauvoir is still, I think, pretty caricatured as either the famous feminist who wrote The Second Sex or Sartre's famous girlfriend, to put it bluntly. And there's much more to her than that. And in French, in 2008, her student diaries were published covering the years from 1926 to 1930. And although those are partly now available in English, reading them in the context of the philosophical preoccupations of the time led me to approach Beauvoir's philosophy differently, and consequently to approach her relationships and her feminism in a slightly different light.
Now, for our audience who's not familiar with Beauvoir, can you please tell us who she was and why she's significant and why we should bother with her now?
Okay, well, that's it's a huge question. So she's significant in that she was a historically pioneering woman. She was born in 1908. She was one of the youngest people ever to pass the Agrégation exam, which is one of the most competitive exams in French philosophy. She went on to teach philosophy for 10 years, and then she turned to writing literature as well as philosophical essays, political essays in the 1940s. But she shot to fame in the same era as the person with whom she did have a lifelong relationship, Jean-Paul Sartre. And so a lot of her own originality, I think, and her own philosophical contributions to existentialism, which is one of the most famous 20th century philosophical movements, have been, I think, occluded by certain details about her personal life. So yes, she went on to be a prize-winning novelist. She wrote The Second Sex, and she turned to feminist activism and campaigning in different ways at different points in her career. She was also an anti-colonial activist who was very, very opposed to the French presence in Algeria. And so I think her life is just rich and a kind of fascinating, it's a fascinating presence to a lot of interesting times in 20th century history.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about her background, the time that she grew up in, you know, her early life, her family? Can you talk about that and a little bit about her relationship with her parents?
Yes. So one of the reasons that I think biography is such an interesting way to approach Simone de Beauvoir is that her own philosophy was developed in conversation with psychoanalysis and in conversation with questions about whether we're free to become who we want to be or determined by our past or certain features of our bodies. And so her own childhood played a significant role in the person that she became. And her parents were originally from quite wealthy French backgrounds. And but they were living through a period in history where it was after the First World War. There were a lot of financial losses as a consequence of the war to her family in particular. And it was a period when women of her social milieu would have been expected to marry off with large dowries to suitable men who got the approval of the parents. But because her parents lost so much of their fortune, she was in a situation of needing to get an education and needing to be employed when that was not quite comfortable for women of her background to do. So I think that's one relevant feature of her experience. Another is that her parents were divided on questions of religion. So her mother was a devout Catholic woman. And that devotion became, I think, more fierce as the family lost prestige. And so on the one hand, there's this intense religiosity on her mother's side, but her father was a kind of sarcastic, secular men. So in France, there's a long tradition of what they call laïcité, which is the French secularism. And so she attributed this kind of disagreement in the family household as being one of the reasons that she became an intellectual.
It was kind of fortunate that her parents had lost their financial position, because it forced her to get an education in a way, even though she was very interested in that. But if her parents had remained very affluent and retained their full status in their class, she probably would have not had that opportunity, or they would have not relented, at least.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's one of the things that I have found so interesting in writing a biography is just that it shows you with so much force how much contingency there is to a human life. So if her family hadn't lost their fortune when they did, or even if she had been born 5 years earlier, French legislation would have been different about the possibility of being educated in the way that she was. So yes, it is fortunate for posterity that she was born when she was, and these particular kinds of events took place.
Now she went against convention for women of her time, and you really put a lot of emphasis on life choices and how choice, and she did too, how the choices you make really shape who you become. And she made a series of decisions that really kind of went against her parents. And she's also portrayed in most scholarship or writings about her that she rejected religion, marriage, children, or even to some would have said that she rejected her own body as a woman. But I think one of the points you're trying to make in your book is that all those things, particularly her rejection of religion, which I was really zooming in on, because you're the first person that I've seen actually pay attention to that. But it was more nuanced than just an outright rejection or just plain atheism. You talk about how it was a process, and it was more nuanced, and it was never a complete break. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I'd be very happy to do that. So one of the reasons that I'm so interested in this period of French philosophy is that I think that we find a much more theologically informed and nuanced kind of atheism in the discussions of these existentialists. So in my work on Sartre, I have looked at French philosophers who informed his concept of freedom and his understanding of what it means to be a self in time. And one of the things that actually made me suspicious enough to start doing the research for this biography of Beauvoir is that she was reading similar theological thinkers years before she met Sartre. And she was asking herself the same kinds of questions about what it means for a person to have value, or if anyone could have value after the death of God. So in the interwar period, France was having a new wave of reception of Nietzsche and its first wave of reception of Kierkegaard. And so these existentialists, or proto-existentialists, depending on how you define the term, were coming into French thought, but they weren't received as completely foreign thinkers, because both Kierkegaard and Nietzsche were key leaders of Pascal, and the French philosophical context was kind of actually quite lively at that moment in debate over whether the soul of France was a rational soul that you could trace back to Descartes' rationalism, or whether it was a mystical soul that you could trace back to Pascal. And so in Beauvoir's student diaries, you see her quoting from these figures and talking about what to do if there is no God with the kinds of insatiable desire that religion used to promise to satisfy. So you can satisfy your desires for food or sex, at least theoretically, that if there is no God to satisfy the spiritual craving for meaning or justice, then what do we do? And so I think, like, that's a question that stayed with her for her life, and it shaped her contributions to both philosophy and feminism. And so I wanted to highlight it.
Well, I found that your comments on religion really got me thinking and trying to find, I'm trying to make some connections with her too. So she believed that philosophy could not be separated from life. And that's one of the reasons I think, you know, and you make the point, it took so long for her to be really recognized as a philosopher. And she carried this idea of philosophy and life sort of being kind of intertwined in her writing when she was writing novels, because we don't think of novels generally, most people don't think of novels as being a vehicle for philosophy in terms of it doesn't really build this very formal system of arguments. So can you talk a little bit about why she felt that way? And then at the same time, she didn't really feel she was much of a philosopher herself. She saw herself as a writer. This is very interesting to me, because what is philosophy, you know, and what does it mean to be a philosopher?
Yes.
Could you comment on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's such a great question. And I think, you know, the question of the relationship between literature and philosophy, or what Plato and Aristotle refer to as poetry and philosophy, is a long and vexed one. So Plato said that he thought that poets should be banned from the Republic because they maim the thought of those who hear them. But there's a kind of irony to Plato's statement, because he himself used a literary form to express philosophy as a dialogical enterprise. So I think one of the things that has motivated me to raise these kinds of questions in the book is that I think the relationship between literature and philosophy varies not just across time, but across cultures. And in France, the relationship is rather different than it is in 20th century or 21st century Anglo-American philosophy. So in France, there's a history of people using satire. So if you think about Voltaire, for example, the French in the French period of the Lumière, you know, the Enlightenment, there's this literary forms of writing philosophy have a much longer and quite prestigious history. So one of the things that makes asking this question of Beaufort complicated is that we're happy to acknowledge that literary forms of writing philosophy count as philosophy in the case of some men in history. So Kierkegaard, for example, or Nietzsche or Pascal, if they're aphorisms and essays. But in Beaufort's case, it seemed to me that even her autobiographical writings could be considered philosophical autobiography in the tradition of Rousseau or even Augustine's Confessions, but they haven't. So, or at least they haven't on a widespread basis. So it's very difficult to say that sexism is definitely the reason that this is the case, because the relationship between literature and philosophy in different cultures is also operative here. But I think one of the reasons I found her work so fascinating is because she decided that it wasn't really the most powerful way to speak to the people that she needed to speak to write in the forms of academic philosophy. So, you know, using the power of literature and autobiography, her work reached everyday women in France and eventually around the globe in ways that, you know, arguments in a philosophical style rarely do.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Now, you know, her theme that I just see in all her work is the idea of subjectivity.
Yes.
And in her, and we look at her fictions, her novels, her memoirs, her essays, and then we look at the letters from women who wrote to her, the letters she wrote to Sartre, and all the people that she was entangled with. Part of the difficulty of understanding Beauvoir is so much of this stuff, it seems contradictory. And we don't know if they're contradictory because life is messy, you know, and life is complicated, and our lives are full of contradictions, or whether it was done on purpose, whether she was trying to complicate, or maybe she was hiding. What's your feeling on that? The fact that all her work, it seems at times, the more we know about her, the less we know.
So I think that's a really good question. And I suppose it raises the question, like, when can we claim to know another person? And as a biographer, I wouldn't claim to know who she was. I mean, I say in the introduction that I'm not claiming to give people the real Beauvoir, because I don't think it's possible to achieve a God's eye point of view. And so I think... I would hesitate to say that she's contradictory, because I think that there are times in her life when her values clearly change and her philosophical commitments clearly change. And I think she tries to live with integrity to those philosophical commitments at the time. And she doesn't always succeed, but that seems to me very human.
No, that's right. I mean, I think that's right. Yeah. I think we're looking sometimes for a unity, a wholeness in a person's life through all their work that really is not possible, especially the way she wrote, you know, with novels and memoirs and all that. It's very difficult to try to come up with a singular, all-encompassing, like, system that she lived by. Consistently, because none of us can do that. So let me ask you about how has she been underestimated, and how does she come to represent both feminism's best impulses? I mean, the best of feminism, and also the worst parts of it too. She's not even a hero for all feminist thinkers, and some of them don't like her.
Yep.
You know, and at times she actually does things that seem very traditional, you know, that you would expect a traditional woman to do. Can you talk about how this is the problem with Beauvoir? It's very difficult to cast her in one way or another. You want to comment on that?
Yes. I mean, I think one of the things that I find really interesting about how divisive a figure she is that I wonder why, or what people think we need out of somebody who's a feminist figurehead. Do we need someone who's perfect, someone who conforms to exactly our ideas, or do we need someone who challenges us, and sometimes challenges us by making us very uncomfortable, in order to discover what our own ideas are? Now, I think Beauvoir never claimed to be an example to women. She did not want to set herself up in this way. And there are several places where she says that this is the pace, and she also says that it's a frustrating dimension of having a private life, that people then think you have to live up to not only your own ideas. I should have said it's a frustrating dimension of having a public life. Not only to have to live up to your own ideals, but then to have other people condemn you for not living up to theirs. So I think in terms of Beauvoir's legacy, there are a lot of factors that contribute to how contested it is. I think one of the factors is that the translation, the first English translation of The Second Sex was so poor. I mean, there's a lot of research that's been done on this by Tom Moore and Margaret Simons, among others. And we know now that it was translated without the philosophical rigor of the French, and only about 85% of it made into English, and a lot of women's voices were cut. So problematically, what that meant is that for over half a century, the English-speaking world was reading that book without actually reading a lot of Beauvoir's words. And one of the things that I find very interesting to think with is that Simone de Beauvoir never uses the word gender in The Second Sex. It's not there. She talks about things like les données biologiques, the biological givens. She talks about les structures physiologiques, the physiological structures of existence. But because the English translation of the book was just careless philosophically, a whole half century's worth of scholarship got started which really, I think, didn't have her conceptual apparatus.
Yeah, the English translation, it has incredible amount of influence in America.
Yeah.
And if you just read that and don't read, you've got to read a lot of her other work, and you also probably need to read the Second Sex in the French,
yeah.
The original French. So let's talk about the big elephant in the room, which is her relation with Sartre.
Yeah.
How did she meet him, Jean Bon Sartre? They had a very lifelong relationship, and why did he become so important in her life? And what was their famous pact?
So the famous pact has become the stuff of legend in France and around the world, because in 1929, they had a beautiful backdrop. They were sitting outside the Louvre and in Paris and basically having a defining the relationship conversation. And they said that they would be necessary to each other, but that it was okay to have contingent lovers on the side. It was going to be a kind of open relationship, but an open relationship in which they were primary in each other's lives. It's the story of the relationship that unfolds in the student diaries is actually, I think, very interestingly different from the narrative that she constructs in the memoirs, and which then became famous, because we see that in the student diaries, she's already committed to the idea that it's possible to love more than one person at the same time. So a lot of feminist readers had assumed that she was Sartre's victim in this act, and that he was basically proposing to do outside of marriage what many men at the time did inside of marriage, by demanding her fidelity and taking advantage of his own infidelity. But in the diaries, you see things from her point of view before she even meets Sartre. And it's quite funny in places, because she didn't like him immediately. She was much more interested in someone else. But it's also interesting because after they do form this intense intellectual friendship, she quite quickly says in her diaries that he's first in her life only in one sense. And she says, and I quote, in the book, that he is first not in her body or her heart, because there many others could be, but that he is the incomparable friend of her heart. So that's a quote from her own words. And I think what she found in Sartre is, I sometimes find it difficult to decide whether it's really moving or tragic or both. There's someone who wouldn't criticize her for thinking philosophically. So her cousin, when she was romantically interested in, didn't like it when she spoke like an intellectual. A lot of the other men in her life didn't like it when she talked about philosophy. But Sartre wanted to know what she thought about Leibniz. And Sartre wanted to talk with her about writing novels and the kinds of questions about philosophy and literature that preoccupied them both before they met each other.
Would you describe what I gather from reading about her and reading your book also is that her relation with Sartre was actually ultimately a platonic relationship in the full sense of platonic, okay? Sense of the word. Would you say that was true or not?
So, not at all stages of the relationship.
Right.
Yeah, so I think that initially she thought that she was going to find someone that she could have a kind of more traditional romantic relationship with, as well as this intellectually fulfilling one. But it became clear quite quickly that that wasn't going to work with Sartre. He did not appreciate her emotions. He didn't have the same theory of what literature could do that she did. He was very, very negative about the body and the female body in particular. And so she, I think, went in with hopes that quickly had to be adjusted in light of his own philosophical commitments and behavior, ultimately.
So can we really disentangle her from Jean-Paul Sartre? Because she, throughout her life, she really... she had opportunities to leave him and to really make a break and stand on her own in terms of intellectually, stand on her own emotionally and socially, but she never did. Can we ever really disentangle those two people?
No, I don't think we can. And I don't think it would be consistent with her philosophy to do so either, because whatever else Sartre was, he was someone who's conversation and criticism she appreciated for her entire life. They read each other's manuscripts. They argued with each other intensely. And some of those arguments ended up shaping, 20th century philosophy in really interesting ways. So I don't think it would be consistent with the historical record to try to separate them. But I also don't think that it would be consistent with her own philosophy, because she says that becoming a self is something that we do with other people. So our freedoms are constrained in crucial ways by the people that we go through life with, but they're also liberated because the people that we go through life with open up different possibilities to us. And I know it doesn't always make feminists comfortable that she quote unquote, didn't leave him. But if you read things like Nelson Algren's letters from the late 1940s, so less than 20 years after the relationship began, he refers to them as having separated. So romantically, they were separated, but they remained friends and critics and part of each other's daily lives for a long time afterwards.
Now, you just brought something up that in terms of relationships, that she struggled philosophically or existentially to clarify or to figure out this tension between devotion to others, love, and retaining her freedom.
Yeah.
This, I want to be free, but I know that I can't really fully be free without, I've got to have other people. But if I'm too devoted to other people, then I lose my freedom. So there's this tension between, I guess, freedom and duty or love, the duty of love, the loyalty. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, so this is one of the things that I think is so interesting. It's a thread that you can trace from the 19-year-old Simone de Beauvoir to the Beauvoir that's writing in 1970, you know, when she's in her 60s. So in her student diaries, she's already asking the question, what does it mean to love ethically? Because she's seen in her life that love doesn't seem to be something that men and women are expected to do in the same way. She saw a lot more self-negation and self-sacrifice in the lives of women, and a lot more self-centeredness, frankly, and the family members that she had, but also in the literature that she read. So ideals of love were not proportionate. And already in the student diaries, she says that what's needed is a love that isn't too centered on the self, but also that isn't too centered on the other. Because if you get excessive self-sacrifice, that's problematic. And if you get excessive self-centeredness, that's problematic too. So she talks about the right balance as equilibrium or reciprocity. And she returns to these two poles of either excessive or inadequate love or defective love in later work. So I think you see her discussing terms like devotion in the ethical text from the 1940s. It comes up in The Second Sex. And but what she says, because of her understanding of what it means to be a self in time, is that equilibrium is not something that you achieve once and for all. If you are in the situation of being in a loving relationship with a friend or partner who also wants your relationship to be ethical, both of you have to struggle to keep the equilibrium that shows commitment to the other, but respects that the other person is a process of is in the process of becoming, and that they are changing in time just like you are. So love is a commitment that has to be remade over and over again in life if you want it to remain ethical.
Well, she her pact with Sartre and their relationship impacted all other relationships that she had. And she had multiple relationships, one notably, of course, with Nelson Algren, but there were others. And can you tell how did that relationship she had with Sartre, which actually was probably ended up being her primary relationship throughout life in her life, affect her commitment to others?
Well,
did she struggle with that? Did she struggle with that or not? Maybe she didn't.
I think she did in some ways, but I still think that this is a way in which the relationship had been misunderstood. So when she says to Algren that she won't move to America, he says to her that he doesn't want to move to France, and so they're at this impasse because they both love each other, but neither of them is willing to leave their home country. And a lot of people will have assumed that this is just because she doesn't want to leave Sartre. But what she says is that she can't leave the place, the only place where her work could have a meaning. And I think if you read Beauvoir in French and you see the way that she's alluding to French literature without necessarily even telling you that she's doing it, the way that she uses wit and she takes famous sentences from well-known French texts and subverts them, I think shows that she saw herself as very much committed to her context. I mean, she one of the most important concepts in her philosophy is the concept of situation. And she thought that her situation needed to be in France primarily. So I think her relationship with Sartre did play a role in some of the kinds of, in all of the relationships she had, it has to be admitted. But I don't think that should be the only thing that's taken into consideration when we look at why she made some of the choices she did.
Okay. Now let's talk about her relationship with women,
mm-hmm.
which becomes really complicated.
Yeah.
Because she claimed that she was not a lesbian, But she had same-sex encounters and was not, particularly, she didn't see it as problematic. But, you know, of course, a feminist after her, would say she was, acting in bad faith because she would never really embrace lesbianism. And so what was her relationship with women? And there were also triangles between her, women, and Sartre that got very complicated and ethically messy. So can you talk about, did she fell other women? Was she a cavalier towards other women?
At certain points in her life, yes. And I think that would have been her assessment. In certain cases, we have documents that show it is her assessment that significant failures have had very negative impacts on the lives of others. And so I think, but this is another case where I think her views changed over time. And she, those relationships, the famous trios that have often been glamorized and used to distract people from Beauvoir's ideas, that happened before she went on to develop her views of ethics and before she wrote The Second Sex and before she became a feminist activist. And I think there are a lot of transformations in her relationships with women, both at the kind of particular level, but also at the more general level of how she decides to engage with challenges to women in society.
So that gets us to, so was she a lesbian? That's the question. No?
Well, she didn't. She believed that homosexuality was a choice. So I think we have to acknowledge that she occupies a very different historical context, and existentialism in general doesn't really believe, it denies the metaphysical possibility of a lot of identity claims. So philosophically, the question for her, I think is a strange one to ask.
I got it. So now she comes along and she writes The Second Sex because really she kind of starts off, as most of her work is involved, with her own personal sort of question she's asking herself. She didn't set out to I'm going to write a feminist theory that's going to change the course of feminist theory or establish feminist theory for the world. That was not her intent. What was her intent?
So there are a couple of places where she expresses it in different ways. So one is that she had been very impressed by Michel Léris's book, Manhood, which is called L'Homme in French. And she thought it would be interesting to see a similar book written about women. Another example or another account that we have of the motivations for the book from her letters to Nelson Algren is that she had read the very influential text by Gunnar Myrdal called The American Dilemma, which was about the situation of Black people in America and which was published in the 1940s. So she had read An American Dilemma by Gunnar Myrdal, and the Myrdal in that text talks about the principle of accumulation and it being different from a vicious cycle, because you have a kind of accumulation of lack of opportunity, which makes it look like lack of ability. And Beauvoir said that she wanted to write a book that was like this book, but for women. So she was inspired by contemporary texts. And she was inspired by also debates that were happening in French philosophy in the 1940s, because both Sartre and Merleau-Ponty, both of whom were her friends, wrote philosophies of the body, which was pretty revolutionary in Western philosophy. So in Being and Nothingness, there's a large section dedicated to the body in 1943. In Merleau-Ponty's Phenomenology of Perception, there's a lot about embodied consciousness. And she was part of the conversations that led to the publication of both of those books. And she thought that there were problematic dimensions of them because they took the male body to be the norm of embodied experience and questions of phenomenology like time and space. And she thought it might be the case, at least on one reading, that these structures were different if you were in a female body.
Okay, so how was the second sex received in France?
So it was received with shock and disdain and a lot of shaming tactics from the literary establishment. Prior to that time, she'd written philosophical essays. She'd written some very well-received novels and a play and co-founded an influential journal with French. But when that came out, Camus accused her of making the French male look ridiculous, and other people said much more intimate and insulting things. And I think one of the reasons I found writing a biography of her life so interesting is because it became very clear to me that one of the recurring criticisms of Simone de Beauvoir was that she thought feminism was still relevant. So in 1944, women won the right to vote, which they first exercised in France in 1945. And so just 4 years after first voting, she was accused of being passé and of harping on about problems that had already been solved. But she was read by people in positions of less power as talking about things that had never been spoken about, frankly, before, and opening up new possibilities for her life. So it's really interesting to see how the kind of public furore is accompanied by just a really much warmer reception in private.
Now, she, in regard to her relationship with feminism, I think it's really important to clarify that when she talks about in the second sex that feminism is practically over, she's talking about the political movement for rich women to get the vote. And she really kind of distanced herself from the feminism before, I would say, you know, before the war. And she doesn't really embrace feminism with a political agenda till late in life. Would you not say that? And what causes her to change her mind and decide that she'd always been working on behalf of the female sex in terms of her writing and trying to explore that? But she was doing it as a philosopher. She was doing it at the level of culture. But for most of her life, she wasn't really involved in like feminist activism till later. Can you talk about that?
Yes. Yes, so I think there's a transformation in her commitments in the 1950s, which is getting more attention in the scholarship now. And so she acknowledges when she reflects back on her past later in life that in the 1940s, she was very elitist. She did not conceive of the second sex as a activist text. She thought it was a theoretical work of philosophy. And she was surprised initially, you know, it was taken up in that way, but it opened up new possibilities for her in the world. And so one of the things that I think is really interesting is that after the second sex, women wrote to her and they said, why did you write this book in this alienating language of the intellectual elite? Why did you make it 1,000 pages? This is too important only to be read by people who have doctorates in philosophy. And so there's this kind of outpouring of appreciation for the book, but also the sentiment that it's a missed opportunity to reach the people who need it most. And in the 1950s, there's an essay that she wrote, Privilege, where she says that intellectuals are often guilty, even when they identify with the politics of the left in France, of keeping their privilege, their cultural privilege to themselves, and only writing for their peers instead of engaging with people where these ideas could have really transformative effects on their lives. So that is something that she writes just before she starts writing her memoirs. And in the French publicity information for the memoirs, she says that she's not writing a straight autobiography, but that she's trying to write the theory of second sex and apply it to her own life. So it's true that she's still using culture as a way of fighting sexist ideals, and perhaps this still seems elitist, but the readership of her letters changes dramatically at that point, and people start to ask her, because they say that she'd come down from a pedestal, and that they'd never imagined her hungry or cold before, or they never thought that they could actually be like her. But the portrait that she painted was so identifiable that she started to get a very different kind of following. And so it's after that point that she starts to get invitations to participate in different kinds of political campaigns, and also significantly after her activism for anti-colonization. So in the late 1950s, when France was in turmoil about its relationship with Algeria, I think Beauvoir got a very different kind of social conscience. And then in the 60s and 70s, you see her engaged in feminist politics and legislation much more.
So with all that has been written about Simone de Beauvoir, do you believe that her influence, the full story of her influence has been told?
I think that's a dangerous question to say yes to, because with philosophers of her stature, I think they continue to be read by different generations in different ways, because the situations of readers change, and that therefore the readings change when ideas stand the test of time. And I think her ideas, some of them at least, will stand the test of time, and that I have certainly not said or written the last word.
So what's her legacy? What do you want the reader to take away from your book?
So I suppose I'm not really temperamentally inclined to want people to take one thing away. My hope is to show that that her story is both more inspiring and more complex than we thought, but perhaps for different reasons. So to raise these questions about concepts like love and why it is that a friendship between a man and a woman arouses so much suspicion or so much, suspicion is a good word. I mean, this relationship has been reduced to a conventional erotic plot, or at least an unconventional erotic plot, when the kind of love that was involved, I don't think, was as traditional as people have thought.
Okay, well, thank you, Kate. Thank you for this time. And thank you to our listeners for tuning in to another edition of New Books in Gender Studies. This is your host, Lillian Barger.